Hi, this is Circulating Ideas, the Librarian Interview Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Thomas, and our first guest today is Buffy Hamilton. Buffy, the unquiet librarian at Creekview High School in Canton, Georgia, is a 19-year veteran educator and passionate about creating meaningful learning experiences for her students. She is the GATE GLMLA School Library Media Specialist of the Year 2010 for the state of Georgia, and her library media program was named one of the two exemplary high school media programs in Georgia in 2010. Buffy's Media 21 program is an ALA OITP 2011 Cutting Edge Service Award winner, and she's a 2011 Library Journal Mover and Shaker. She blogs at The Unquiet Librarian, which is www.theunquietlibrarian.wordpress.com, and for ALA Learning. You can follow her on Twitter at Buffy J. Hamilton. Hi, Buffy. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to join you today.
My first question is, I'm going to ask the general, just The Unquiet Library. How did you come up with that name, and what led you to come up with a name for it? Because generally, when I think of school media centers, they just call it the media center. They don't really have a name for it.
That's a great question. When I opened our library in 2006, I really wanted to create a different kind of experience for our students and teachers. And so I knew that a media center, as you stated, is just sort of a generic term. And I wanted to come up with a label or a brand, if you will, for the library that would be something memorable. So I was inspired by a book that I had read in graduate school at the University of Georgia called Library, An Unquiet History by Matthew Battles. And I felt like that title, in many ways, really sort of captured the essence of the idea that I wanted to convey about our library program, that it was going to be a place that was unquiet and teeming with conversations for learning. And so I debuted the label, I guess, in February of 07, I think is when I began our blog. And it actually has turned out to be a great marketing vehicle, if you will, because that's what everybody knows us as now, is the Unquiet Library. So that's the story of how that moniker came to be for our library program.
And do the students like that name as well?
Yeah. Oh yes, they really do. And that's actually, if they come into the library and a teacher, asks them to perhaps, dial down their vocal level just a bit, their immediate response is, "But this is the Unquiet Library."
Of course.
So yes, they do like that term. It's catchy. So thank you to Matthew Battles for writing a wonderful book, which I recommend as a read, by the way, if you haven't read it. But hopefully, we're maybe adding now a new chapter to the history of libraries with the work that we're trying to do, and really putting the emphasis on learning and not things per se as the focal point of our program and the services that we're trying to provide.
Right, and that sort of leads into a question I was going to ask about with the discussion of that. I would just say that Seth Godin blog, and that everybody knows which one I'm talking about.
Oh yes, that post.
Yes. Obviously, all different librarians had all the different views. There were blog posts all over the place that day. Different people. Some people were offended by it. Some people were embracing of it. I know you were on the embracing side of what he had to say. One part of that I found odd is that every time somebody, usually of somebody of Seth Godin's stature outside the system, outside the profession, whenever they write about libraries, librarians go crazy. We seem to have this sense of needing to control how we're perceived. We don't like the way some people perceive us sometimes, and I wonder if sometimes the problem is us not projecting what we're doing, because a lot of the people who were complaining about Seth Godin blog were like, well, we're already doing this, we're already doing that, but maybe the problem is people don't know we're doing those things.
I think it is. It's very interesting, the range of responses that his original post generated. And I think, there was a lot of really healthy discourse, but certainly, as you've observed, I think some of those responses maybe did come from, I don't know if defensive is maybe the right word, but maybe from, that type of stance. And perhaps maybe more than ever, sometimes people, you know, their immediate reaction is to, you know, try to defend what we're doing, because certainly I think there is a lot of concern about, you know, the health, if you will, of the profession.
Right.
But, you know, I felt like, you know, his overall points, you know, did, as people pointed out, you know, hit on a lot of the services or philosophies that many libraries are espousing. But it, as you pointed out, you know, there is, I think, a perception challenge, and perhaps this is just a reminder that more than ever we need to be transparent about our practice.
Right.
But perhaps we really need to be thinking along the lines of how are we embedding ourselves, and not just in our community, but maybe, you know, in other spaces, if you will, virtually and physically, to help just raise that level of awareness, you know, with people as to, you know, what the 21st century library can be, what those possibilities are. And I think, as you pointed out, some people perhaps were a little ruffled. Yeah, that a perceived outsider, if you will,
yeah,
you know, was, you know, how dare he make suggestions about libraries. But, you know, when you stop and think about it, you know, he is one of the people that, you know, we hope to serve, you know, that we want to try to reach out to people from all kinds of different backgrounds,
right,
and experiences. And so I think for us to at least not acknowledge his viewpoint and to at least give it a careful listen, then I think, you know, we might be making a mistake, and if we just, you know, automatically tune that out. And, you know, it reminds me of a paper, a journal article I read several years ago, again in graduate school, and it was talking about the influence of Oprah's book club, you know, on reading culture in the United States. And, you know, of course, some people, you know, felt, you know, Oprah's book club was fluff. You know, then there was the opposite end of the spectrum, in which people lauded her efforts as, you know, sort of a renaissance of people discovering reading for pleasure and helping people, you know, discover new books.
Right.
But at the beginning of this journal article, there was a quote from Dr. Ann Ruggles Geer, and she talked about, and she was speaking specifically to English professors at the college level, but talking about how we really needed to listen to the sounds and the noise happening outside our classroom and think about how did that impact our practice. And I think that speaks to this whole, you know, Godin post that, you know, maybe, you know, it pushes us into a little bit of level of discomfort or puts us on the defensive, but nonetheless, we need to listen, you know, to what he's saying.
Right.
And certainly, as you pointed out, again, maybe it's just a reminder that we need to find more effective ways of letting people know what libraries can do for our communities.
Yeah, and I think some of it probably is that libraries are being attacked by other people. I mean, like in terms of funding, we're getting our funding cut. And so whenever anybody writes anything at all that's slightly critical of libraries, I think there's just a reflexive action to jump in and defend. And just people, I think people are sort of in a defensive posture right now.
Yes.
And but I think you said, you know, sometimes posts like that and articles like that can make you uncomfortable. I think sometimes we can learn a lot from becoming uncomfortable. And
exactly.
What about that is making us uncomfortable? Is it because we should be doing that? Is that why it's making us uncomfortable? Or, you know, there's things to be learned from that. So.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he challenged, you know, some of the ideals that you know, maybe have traditionally been regarded as pillars, if you will, of librarianship. But, you know, certainly, you know, I think we're in the midst of a sea change. But, you know, when I look at all the different posts and exchanges that happened on Twitter, I think the healthy and positive thing that has come out of this is that it has generated conversations within the profession, as
yes,
well as interested observers, about the mission and the purpose of libraries. And that in and of itself, I think, is a good thing. You know, that is a healthy debate. But it is, as Dr. David Lankes would say, it's a conversation for learning for all of us. So
right.
I think, yeah, it would be interesting to see other voices besides Godin perhaps, you know, chime in and, mm-hmm. you know, let that be an opportunity for dialogue, you know, within and as well as bringing in other voices outside the profession to just help us better inform our practice and better serve, again, our communities.
Right, because I don't think necessarily people have to agree with everything that he had to say, but I think it's, like mm-hmm. I thought Bobby Newman's post was very good. I mean, she didn't agree with nearly anything that he said, but she did a very good job, I think, of taking another viewpoint and showing it, but it got a discussion going and it's talking about things. I mean, it's, discussion is always good.
Absolutely.
You did talk a little bit about, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, David Lankes.
Yes.
His book, The Atlas of New Librarianship. I do have a copy, but I have not yet been able to even crack it open besides a brief flip through it. I got it for my birthday, and just with our summer reading having at my library, I just haven't had time to really get into it. I know you've talked about it several times. Can you talk a little bit about what it is about that book that's really gripped you?
Well, I'm actually about a third of the way through the book. And I should acknowledge I obviously have an interest in it for two reasons. A, I have a very short piece in it, but B, he's someone who's very much influenced my philosophy of librarianship. But I think what is really great about this book is that it has so many different threads of conversation. And like I said, I'm only a third of the way through, but even with what I read and then, you know, just working through or flipping through the structure of the book, I love that it is pulling so many different threads of contemporary librarianship. And quite frankly, if I were teaching, I think, a course, uh-huh. This would, I think, be a must read. And everyone that I've talked to who's reading it, you know, the response has been overwhelmingly positive. And what I really like, you know, with what I've read so far in the book is the focus really is on ideas and services. And again, talking about how do we create these conversations for learning. The whole emphasis is on libraries as centers of learning and the role of the librarian as someone who is a catalyst for connecting people and ideas and passions and helping them to maybe discover passions or things of interest that, you know, they didn't realize that they had. So
yeah.
It's just, I think, a very inspiring and thought-provoking read for any librarian, whether your school, academic, public. There's something in this book for everyone. It transcends, you know, any one particular library environment. So, like I said, I'm only a third of the way through because, like you, it's been a little bit hectic the last few weeks with the end of the school year
and
trying to get ready for some conferences later this month. So far, it has been a really moving read for me. So I'm interested to see, you know, what my thoughts and reactions are as I hope to get into it a little bit more in the next 2 weeks. And there's actually, there's going to be a Twitter reading group for the book. If you go to David's blog, if you just Google Virtual Dave,
mm-hmm.
then you'll hit his blog. And I believe he has a graduate assistant intern who's going to be helping facilitate a Twitter chat book discussion starting, I think, the week of June 20th, if I remember correctly. I just saw that this morning. So, you know, if there are people listening that you maybe want to participate in, you know, sort of an informal conversation about the book, then that might be a great medium for doing that.
Is there anybody else, like Seth Godin or Lankes, inside or outside the profession that you particularly keep an eye on to get ideas from? Because, I know it's important to not just be in that echo chamber of just listening to librarians talk about librarians, and that's another thing about the Seth Godin thing is it's an outside person giving his perspective, which sometimes we need. Are there any other people in particular that you keep up with to get inspiration from?
Well, you know, I think I do, you know, follow a diverse group of voices. Just, you know, off the top of my head, Henry Jenkins is someone whose work I really respect. I follow him primarily through his blog, but he's also on Twitter. Howard Rheingold is another person whose work I really respect and I find intriguing. I primarily, again, follow him through Twitter, but he's actually just recently started, I believe, with Scoop It. He's curating stories or articles or social media threads about this concept of info attention and people being able to cultivate their own information filters, if you will. Mm-hmm. So that's a new medium. I just got my account set up with Scoop. I believe it's Scoop It. I'm following his curated page there. I also really like Digital Media and Learning Central. They always have something that speaks to me of interest. And they really are primarily, I guess, focused a little bit more on education. But it's a diverse group of different scholars, researchers, people who are out in the trenches, in various settings, but the focus is, as their name implies, on digital media and learning. So I really enjoy seeing the stories that they're posting. I was trying to think if there's anyone else. Yeah, there's quite a few, so I don't want to omit anyone.
Right.
Probably, I guess the other person who influences a lot of my thinking, although she's not necessarily blogging regularly, is Wendy Drexler. Wendy is one of the two people, along with Michael Wesch, who really inspired the whole concept of the Media 21 program. Neither of them are librarians, but I think a lot of the work they're doing and their interests intersect, you know, the work that we do as librarians. So Wendy has actually become a wonderful mentor and colleague. She's a sage voice and someone that I really respect tremendously. And she's fairly active on Twitter if you're interested in following her. And as I said, she doesn't blog, I think, quite as regularly as she did. But when she does, it's something that's definitely read-worthy. So
do you know what
those would probably be some people outside of, I guess, librarianship that I really enjoy following.
Do you know what her Twitter handle is?
I believe it's just Wendy Drexler.
Okay.
WendyDrexler.
Okay.
I believe that will take you straight to, yes, that's her Twitter handle.
Okay. And you mentioned the Media 21 program, and I do want to get back to that, so I want to discuss that with you. But just briefly, mm-hmm. while we're talking about Twitter and blogs, how important has that become in your professional development is following? I know that I just clicked over to your Twitter and saw you're following 802 people. How well do you, do you just skim that, or do you have certain times when you read it? That's a lot of people to keep track of.
Yes, it actually was a lot more. I did a pretty significant weeding, if you will, mm-hmm. A couple of months ago. And I think, you know, that is a challenge of a lot of these social media streams. It kind of goes back to Howard Rheingold's concept of info attention, that, you know, you ultimately have to decide in your own mind, maybe just some general guidelines for, you know, criteria for who you're going to follow. Mm-hmm. And also know that, you know, it's organic. You know, it may be that, you know, there are some people that you follow and, you know, for a year they really speak to, you know, your interest or maybe, you know, they're a great source of learning. But then, you know, maybe you're moving on to other ideas and perhaps, you know, their tweeting purposes or content they're sharing may have changed and it's no longer a good fit. So I think, you know, you need to give yourself permission to weed, you know, your social media channels from time to time, just like, you know, you would a collection or your garden, so to speak. But I use a couple of tools. I use TweetDeck, and, you know, of course, there are a lot of filtering options in there if you want to mm-hmm. focus on certain hashtags. But, you know, my activity there, it ebbs and flows. Usually early morning or late night is when I tend to be most active. But, you know, there are periods that things just get very hectic and, you know, I'm away for a little while. But that's the beauty, I think, of, you know, these learning spaces is that, you know, they're flexible, they're fluid. You can be as involved or as uninvolved as you need to be, because the reality is that, you know, our professional and personal lives are happening. And, right. I like that it's elastic and you can customize it to fit your needs as a learner. So Twitter really is a primary channel for learning for me, because, you know, there is such a diverse group of people there. But I do also use Google Reader.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
To track RSS feeds and iGoogle. Some things I'll pull directly onto my iGoogle desktop. But again, you know, I weed that from time to time as well. And what I do like about Google Reader, of course, is that you can create folders. So it mm-hmm. may be, you know, that I have a folder for librarians, a folder for teachers and ed tech people. Then there may be folders for, you know, digital media or social media,
right.
you know, literacy, you know, just different areas of interest. And I think you just have to give yourself permission to know that sometimes things, you know, you can keep up with it really well, and other times it just sort of, it may overflow, and it's okay to just clear all of that and start fresh.
Yeah, that's generally how
Google Readers are flowing.
Yeah, that's generally how I use Twitter, is just sort of I dip in when I have time and jump back out, and I'll respond to something if there's something there to respond to. And I mean, a lot of times I'll just read and follow links. And if there is an important story going on, like the Seth Godin blog or the HarperCollins Overdrive thing, there's enough chatter about it that it'll show up on your stream no matter when you pop in.
You know, I think what I really like about Twitter, other than, you know, it does give me an avenue to interact with a diverse group of people, you know, is that you can use it either as a place to just sort of aggregate resources, but it can also be a place to connect and have conversations with others. And that's what's been really powerful about Twitter for me, is that it's helped me to establish professional relationships with other librarians who aren't necessarily school librarians. Although certainly I've met some really fantastic people, you know, in my corner of the library world.
Right.
But it's also connected me with people, you know, outside of librarianship, but who still are really informing my thinking. A great example, just in the last couple of months, I've connected with Joseph McCallum, who's involved with the National Writing Project, and we share an interest in digital writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm pretty confident we would probably never have connected had it not been for Twitter. And I believe it was the English chat, which is a hashtag ENG chat,
mm-hmm.
and it happens, I believe, every Monday evening at 7 p.m. That's actually how we originally connected. And again, it's not, you know, library per se,
right.
but so much of what happens in that weekly Twitter chat, and of course the work that he's doing with National Writing Project, you know, really speaks to a lot of the work that I'm doing with teachers and students, and, you know, of course, you know, this idea of multiple literacies. So yeah, that's the beauty of Twitter. You know, people can customize and use it in whatever way works best for them. I don't think there's one right way.
Right.
You just have to you know, try it on and figure out, you know, how it works for you, and then, you know, just roll with it.
Well, I think it's important, sort of in this era of shrinking budgets, when not everybody can go to conferences as much as they used to be able to, that this is a way to connect with other professionals without having to go to New Orleans or Anaheim or Chicago or wherever a conference.
Oh, absolutely. And to, you know, experience a lot of the exchange that's happening. ACRL is a great example. It just so happened there was one day of the conference in March that
we were not all that busy in our library because of graduation testing, so we weren't covered up with classes for the entire day like we normally might be. So, you know, I had a small window of time. You know, I had TweetDeck open, and, you know, I was working on some other tasks, but, you know, was kind of monitoring the flow, and all these great resources suddenly were just flowing across, you know, Twitter about presentations on embedded librarianship, and I believe Tara Booth's presentation on, you know, the librarian as, you know, the situated educator. Again, going back to that focus on libraries and learning.
Right.
And even though, you know, I'm not in an academic library, I was so inspired and educated by the content that was coming through that. And again, just was a reminder that, you know, even though we're in different spaces or corners of library world, we share so many interests. And that we need to be communicating with each other so that we're not all, you know, reinventing the same wheel. But again, Twitter gives us a medium to connect. And I actually decided to join ACRL this spring when I renewed my ALA membership as a direct result of experiencing the conference, if you will, through Twitter. And now it's on my must attend list for 2013. So,
fantastic.
You know, I think that's a very, as you point, a very powerful form of professional development, and it doesn't cost a thing.
Yep. Okay, I wanted to get back then to your Media 21 program. Can you just talk about that sort of generally, what it is?
Sure. This was a model that really put participatory learning and students creating and diversifying their own learning environments at the center of, you know, the classroom experience. The other focal point was to give students and the teacher, Susan Lester, who we targeted two sections of 10th grade English, the opportunity to experience the library as a regular part of classroom life. Yeah, and this idea, again, of embedding ourselves in these learning spaces and breaking down the walls, you know, that sometimes exist. And so, you know, I sort of pitched this model to Susan, I believe it was in the spring, late winter, early spring of 2009, and Susan was completely willing to try out these ideas, and so we really worked together for the majority of the school year as co-teachers. You know, originally the project we thought would just be 9 to 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And we wound up working together probably three quarters of the school year. We did have a brief hiatus in early 2010 in January and February. But, you know, we were really focusing on students exploring many different types of information sources, not just the traditional forms of authority, but we were looking at social media as when is that an authoritative source? How do we evaluate and judge that? We were teaching them content creation tools as a medium for publishing their own work, but also as a way of sharing and constructing knowledge with others, whether it was their peers or perhaps experts, you know, outside, you know, our CreekView community that they might connect to, perhaps through their blogs, through Skype. They might grab their RSS feeds and, you know, put it on their Symbaloo page or their NetVibes dashboard. It was really just trying to help them harness the power of technology and cloud computing, not as something else that was on top of classroom life, but that it really, you know, was part of the seamless experience of learning in our classroom. And it was very exciting, you know, for I think all of us, and the students really enjoyed, you know, they pretty much met in the library for most of the year because that space gave us a lot of flexibility for inquiry-based activities, small group work, whole group sharing, and, of course, you know, access to information in ways that sometimes might be a little bit more challenging in the traditional classroom space. So, yeah, I'll tell you that I think Susan and I learned just as much, if not more, than the students from the experience. It was probably one of the most rewarding, gratifying experiences in my career, and we decided to move forward and work with a second group this past academic year. And what's really exciting for us is that now we have other teachers who are interested in this model and who are starting to implement, you know, these principles of participatory learning, mm-hmm. of the network student, if you will, in small segments that, you know, the library is helping scaffold those efforts. And so I'm really excited to see where we're going to go with that for the upcoming academic year. And I think, you know, you're onto something that's powerful when, you know, it's the last day of post planning. And at that point, you know, teachers are typically, they are very weary, they're tired. But, you know, instead, I spent most of my day in small group or one-on-one meetings, brainstorming and dreaming, if you will, ideas that, you know, that teachers want us to help them implement and pilot for the upcoming year. So I'm very thankful that, you know, I have colleagues that are willing to take risks as teachers and learners themselves to give their students an opportunity to have meaningful, authentic learning experiences that are not necessarily defined by a standardized test.
And have you had any interest from other schools or from other librarians of wanting to use your model at their schools?
Yes, I have had some inquiries, you know, over the last 2 years from colleagues, you know, across the country. And we're actually going to be talking a little bit about that at ALA. I'm presenting with a group of school librarians on Saturday, Jennifer Hubert-Swan and some other esteemed colleagues, about how we're embedding ourselves into classrooms and the curriculum. And this whole group presentation really kind of came out of the fact that they really liked the Media 21 model and wanted to pilot those principles and really position themselves as, you know, a co-teacher, if you will, with their classroom teachers across different grade levels and subject areas. So we'll be sharing a little bit about that in a couple of weeks in New Orleans, and I'll make sure that I share and post our slides through Twitter and the blog for anyone who might be interested. So it's very humbling and exciting to feel like something you're doing can inspire others. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it kind of goes back to that bigger idea of how I think social media can be a medium for transforming our practice, because it gives us this way to connect with so many different colleagues and to share and help each other out. And that's what I love about our profession, is that people are so willing to share ideas and to brainstorm with you, to right. talk about the challenges, the joys. I can say without any hesitation that the work that's happening, you know, in our library, in my own ongoing growth, none of that I think would have happened without being connected to so many wise voices through Twitter, blogs, RSS feed. So I'm very, very grateful to live in this information age that we're in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great time to be a librarian. Lots of
it really is. It's exciting. I mean, yes, we have our challenges, but you know, when you get these ideas from other people and you take it and you mold it to work for your library environment, and you see how it helps people or inspires them or changes them in some positive way, it is the best feeling in the world to feel like you've helped someone or that you've made a positive difference.
Right.
And that's what it's all about.
Okay, well, speaking of Twitter, I'm going to ask you a question that someone asked me to ask you. It's Diane Cordell asked me to ask you how your experience as an English teacher affected your approach to librarianship.
That's a really great question. Diane's good at this. I think it's impacted me in two ways. You know, one, I really loved being a teacher. And so I think that was a great fit for me with, you know, the learning focus on libraries. And in my program at the University of Georgia, under the tutelage of Dr. Marianne Fitzgerald, who was my advisor and continues to be a mentor to this day. That really was a driving element of the philosophy of school librarianship at UGA, which is in complete alignment with AASL, which is our National School Library Division of ALA.
Mm-hmm.
That the library is, our mission is learning, to facilitate learning in all formats and mediums. So I think, that was an excellent fit. The other, aspect, though, and I really see this now probably more clearly than ever. My last few years I was teaching, again, this was very much influenced by my studies at UGA, and this was in the language and literacy department, but was really thinking about taking an inquiry stance on literacy in the classroom, an inquiry-based approach, using these critical lenses, if you will, to think about what does it mean to learn, what do we value, who's impacted by that. And I've really come to see just in the last year how this inquiry stance on learning dovetails so perfectly with this model of participatory learning, that it's really a great fit. And of course, those are foundational elements of the library program and of my my philosophy of librarianship. So I think having worked with learners of diverse backgrounds, because I taught regular high school, but I also taught at our evening school campus as mm-hmm. well as the alternative school, those experiences really helped me to see that people learn in very different ways, and that it's not a one-size-fits-all. So as a librarian, I need to be aware of that, and that when we're teaching our students different skills, that we need to be willing and able to help them discover and evaluate information and create content in as many different mediums as possible. To really give them a sense of agency and empowerment as individuals.
And do you find when you're working with students, I know there's sort of this, I think on one of your slides, I think I know your opinion on this, but that whole idea of the digital native, that these kids, because they've grown up with the internet, means that they just know how to use the internet. I assume that strikes me as wrong. And yeah, something that maybe the media just grabbed onto and thought it was a neat idea, and so they thought, oh, it must be true, but
I think that's such a misleading label, and sometimes a dangerous label, because it leads to assumptions, and I think in some ways it maybe discriminates based on age. I think everybody comes with different experiences and different exposure, and I've found that students, they know how to surf, the web. They know about YouTube. They know about texting. But it's a very surface-level knowledge with many of these students. Now some will. They do come with a very deep knowledge of how to manipulate and use, these channels of information. But many of them really come with a very limited background, because they've just not had much exposure either at home or at school. So I see, that's where we have the opportunity to introduce and provide learning experiences that will help them explore how they can harness the power of these different technologies and tools that are available to them in positive ways that are constructive, and helping them to establish a positive digital footprint or digital identity. I've seen students that they'll flat out tell you they hate technology. I had a group this year that they weren't ugly about it, but they were very apprehensive. And I think it was important for us to acknowledge and honor that anxiety, that fear, and to try to help them find ways to work through it and give them positive experiences to mitigate some of those negative feelings, and vice versa. You know, I have teachers that have 30 years of experience, and you introduce something to them, and they take to it like a duck to water, sometimes more so than teachers, you know, maybe with less experience. So I think we have to be careful with labels. And I know, you know, as a culture, we love to label and categorize things. But I think we do have to be careful about that, because it leads to false assumptions and winds up in us not being able to, as Lauren Presley would say, you know, meet learners of any age at their point of need.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's where the idea of transliteracy comes in, and that's idea important for them to understand, because that can help them, even if they understand how to use a lot of these YouTube or whatever, email, any kind of technology, of knowing when to use each one. I mean, what's the appropriate time to use, or the proper method to get an idea out.
Exactly. And sometimes just even, you know, different contexts which they could use it. You know, they of course, you know, they get their songs from iTunes, but you know, maybe they don't realize, you know, I could create my own book. You know, I could create a digital, you know, book report or a digital story, if you will.
Right.
And, you know, put it up for sale if I wanted to on iTunes. That I can be, you know, someone who creates meaningful content and contributes something positive, you know, out there to the information world. So sometimes, you know, that's the exciting part of what we do, is just showing them what the possibilities could be, and then giving them ownership of, you know, how creative they want to be, or, you know, directions that they then want to, you know, take those tools and go with them for their own purposes.
Okay, so I've got one final question. This is another one that came from Twitter. I sent out a message asking if anybody wanted me to ask you any questions, and this was one I got multiple times. Everybody wants to know, how do you sleep? When do you find time to sleep?
You know, that there's this perception out there that I don't sleep, and it's funny that that came up on Twitter, and interestingly enough, everywhere I go, that's one of the first things that people ask, or they bring it up when they introduce me. You know, I think some of that may have come out of when I opened our library program. I actually was teaching evening school for the first 3 years. So, you know, I would do my library thing all day, and then I'd run home, and then, you know, I would teach typically either from 7 to 11 or 6 to 10 p.m. at night, which was a bit of a hectic schedule, but was a great learning experience for me. I loved teaching night school. It was a fantastic experience. But it did put me home at a late hour, and so... you know, sometimes you have to kind of wind down for the evening. So sometimes that would be my time that I'd be active on my blog or Twitter. So I think that's where that started. But I really do sleep. I try to get a healthy amount of sleep. Although, again, I think it's like anybody else. You'll get, you know, periods of time that ebbs and flows, or you have deadlines, and
right.
You know, the adrenaline's pumping, and you get, or you just get in such a state of flow, or you're so engrossed in something you've discovered, and I have to kind of watch myself with this, because, you know, I'll come across some interesting nugget on Twitter, and, you know, it's like going down, you know, the rabbit's hole in right. Alice in Wonderland. You know, 5 hours later, you know, I've explored all these different ideas, and I'm excited, and, you know, I'm brainstorming, and, you know, it's late in the evening or in the wee small hours of the morning. But but on a serious note, I know I do try to get a healthy amount of sleep, because it does impact your health.
Yes.
And so I try to get at least 6 hours a night and not lose too much of it. But
yeah, I think people
probably just... I think people catch me at hours that that maybe leads to that perception.
Well, and you're kind of out there everywhere. You're on your blog. You're on you're on Twitter. You're doing conferences. You're writing papers, and we just kind of see you everywhere, Buffy.
I don't know. I think I will say I think I can be very focused and very efficient, and I think part of that comes from, yeah, I've had my mother and my three grandmothers who all had a very strong work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, part of that influences that. But I also run, and I've done one marathon and a couple of halves, but so much of running is mental concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, again, just kind of getting, you know, lost in, you know, that sense of flow, you know, which you're just so engaged in what you're doing, you do lose track of time. I think, you know, sometimes that's part of it, or I know if, you know, I really need to concentrate on something, then I can do that. Like I said, I feel fortunate to be in this profession at this time because it is so exciting, and to be able to learn from others and to share and just to be part of this, you know, fantastic learning community. I find it energizing. I'm grateful to be part of it.
That's great. So thank you for being a part of my first show, Buffy.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to reflect and share with all of you. So thank you.
If you'd like to know more about the podcast, you can visit us on the web at www.circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at @circulatingidea. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can email the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time.